Welcome, everybody. This is the last lecture, Lecture 8 on Money, Credit, and Interest for the Mises Academy class, Mises on Money and Banking, where we did a quick tour of the theory of money and credit. And what we've finally been built up to in this class and this final lecture is going to be what Mises in this book refers to as the circulation credit theory of the trade cycle, and of course what we now refer to as Austrian business cycle theory. So you can see this is what we're going to go over, and as usual for this class, if you get this PowerPoint, that will probably help you because there is a lot of information on it. Let me mention one thing which I don't think is going to come up later in the lecture, so let me say it right now before I forget. Why does Mises call it the circulation credit theory of the trade cycle? Well, first of all, trade cycle is just what they used to call business cycle, right? So that's not a mystery. But the circulation credit theory, because remember, as we talked about last week, Mises distinguishes between commodity credit and circulation credit, right? So for him, so what's credit? That's a transaction involving an exchange of present for future goods. But, and so commodity credit, Mises was saying that, is a case where somebody gives up present goods to somebody else, and the other person is promising to give back future goods in exchange. So there's like an intertemporal transaction there, and the person who is receiving present goods right now does so, in a sense, at the expense of the person who surrenders his command over present goods in the present. And so Mises calls that commodity credit. So that seems pretty straightforward. But then circulation credit, Mises says, is a situation where there is a credit transaction involved. One party is pledging to pay future goods back to the other party, meaning in the future we're going to give you stuff. But, and one party is receiving command over present goods right now, but yet the other party is not surrendering command over present goods. And from one perspective, that seems impossible, but Mises clarifies, and he says this involves fiduciary media. So there you have the odd situation where it seems to be that a bank, commercial bank, can make a loan to somebody, so somebody who wants to go buy a house, let's say, and just has the down payment and needs to borrow 90% of the price of the house, and the commercial bank can say, okay, here you go, and issue, you know, grant the credit, so to speak, and then when you say, okay, well then who now in society has that much less money to spend because of that decision, then the answer is nobody, to the extent that that loan was granted completely with fiduciary media. So that's an odd thing, and that's what Mises calls circulation credit, so that's why he refers to his business cycle theory as the circulation credit theory of the trade cycle. He's going to show, now that he's explained the nature of money, the nature of banking, the nature of fiduciary media, now he's going to bring it all together in this critical chapter 19 and show how these things affect the rate of interest, and then he's going to rely on the Bamberkian framework and show that actually, you know, if we walk through the paces of this progression, look what happens. We end up with the theory of the trade cycle. Okay, so let's get into the PowerPoint here. Okay, so slide number one is the problem. And so Mises, at the very start of this chapter, says, here's what I'm going to be doing. He's going to look at the connection between the amount of money in circulation. And it's interesting, Mises uses that term, or at least the translator made that the English rendition of it, uses that phrase money in circulation, whereas a lot of times Austrians are reticent to use that terminology because, let me just go off on a little tangent here, I'll try not to take too long because we've got a lot of material, but this is kind of important. Generally speaking, Austrians tend not to like that phrase to talk about money in circulation, because the whole point is the Austrian approach, or at least the Misesian approach, and then Murray Rothbard adopted it and modern day Rothbardians all like this approach when it comes to money, is to not picture money as moving around the economy, but rather to have a cash balance approach, to look at it from the individual's demand to hold money. And so when you come at it that way, that's how they build up their monetary theory. So yeah, you got the supply of money or the quantity at any given time, and then every piece of money, every unit, has to be in somebody's possession at any moment. It's not like there's literally money that nobody wants. Right? Even if someone's trying to get rid of the money, they're not going to throw it away. They're going to trade it for something, or they're going to exchange it. And so the point is, at any given time, take a snapshot, every unit of money must be in somebody's cash balance. And so the Austrians typically don't like that phrase to talk about how much money is there in circulation, because in a sense they say, well, there isn't money in circulation, it's always in somebody's possession. Okay, but be that as it may, beginning of this chapter, Mises says what he's going to do is explore the connection between the amount of money in circulation and the rate of interest. And he goes on to say, so far in the book, in the first 18 chapters, he has been looking at the money relation, the interaction of the supply of and demand for money, and how that affects the prices of consumer goods. But he hasn't really been talking about how it affects the prices of producer goods or production goods. Okay, so let me just say that in different words. Mises is acknowledging, he's saying, look, earlier in the book, I have in fact talked about the connection between money and prices, and specifically how changes in the supply of and demand for money affect prices, but it was always in the context of consumer prices, the prices of consumer goods. And now we're going to ask, is there actually a differential impact, right? So just give you an example. Earlier, Mises was talking about the fact that, hey, if the supply of money increases more than the demand, then that's the only coherent definition we can give to the term inflation. And that would tend to lower the purchasing power of money or raise prices. And now he's going to get more specific, though, and say, does it just raise all prices, or does it have a differential impact upon consumer good prices versus producer good prices? And so at first, you might think it would be the same. And he talks about this in this beginning of chapter 19. Because he says, in terms of modern value theory, we explain, first of all, in terms of the logical progression of the theory, so we're not necessarily talking about historically how things happen in terms of T1, T2, T3, but rather if we're going to using logical building blocks try to coherently build up an explanation of market prices, first of all, we use marginal utility analysis, things like that, to explain the prices of consumer goods and services. And then from that, we can derive the prices of the factors of production that go into making them. So the standard example here is to say, it's not that, according to modern subjectivist value theory, it's not that bottles of champagne are expensive because the land that has the vineyards of the type of grapes that are needed to make that kind of champagne is really expensive. And so, oh, well, because the costs of production are real high, those bottles of champagne must be expensive in order for the farmers who tend the, you know, those vineyards to be able to at least break even. That the modern economist says, no, that's crazy. Really what happens is we use marginal utility analysis to explain why consumers are willing to pay so much on the margin for one more bottle of champagne, and then given that that's the equilibrium market price of bottles of champagne, that then percolates upward through the different stages of production. It means that farmers, when they're trying to decide what to plant on their scarce plots of land, will realize, oh, well, if I grow these kind of grapes that can be used in the production of this champagne, I'll get such and such a return. And so I do that, whereas, you know, if consumers are really demanding more ketchup, then that might bid up the price of tomatoes, you know, the wholesale price of tomatoes, and then the farmers might say, oh, I'm going to use more of my land to grow tomatoes rather than grapes or whatever. Okay, so that's the kind of stuff Mises is talking about there. And so he's saying, you know, at first glance, you might think that what we've been doing thus far in the book is fine, that we've just been talking about how do changes in the supply of and demand for money affect consumer good prices, and then because those ultimately are what cause or generate or determine, whatever verb you want to use, because consumer good prices eventually do that to producer good prices, you might just think we don't need to deal with this issue. But it turns out that's not a simplification you want to make. It actually is crucial, and that's what Mises is going to do in this chapter 19, to break it up and ask, is there a differential impact on consumer good prices versus the prices of higher order goods when there's a change in the money relation? Okay. Let me jump ahead. Okay. I'm just jumping ahead to make sure I wasn't missing a point, because I know I wanted to hit something, but I account for it later on. Okay, we're fine. So now I'm on slide A, review of von Bawerk on interest. So here, with the limited time we have, I can't give you the full story, but it is necessary for you to understand the basics of Eugen von Bawerk's approach to capital and interest theory. I'm trying to think. So if you go and read my Mises.org daily archives, you'll get a good view of this stuff. A few years ago, I spent some time, like there's a period there where I hit like four articles in a relatively short time on von Bawerk and his interest theory. And if you're really a masochist, you can try reading my dissertation. But for our purposes right now, let me just give you the basics, the essentials that you need in order to make sense of chapter 19. Okay, so the first thing is that might be throwing you is you have to understand von Bawerk, when he talks about interest, and specifically what he called originary interest, he wasn't referring to somebody lending units of money to somebody else and then saying, what's the percentage rate or premium that you're going to pay me for the use of my money for a certain amount of time. So I think typically right now when people think of interest, they think of it as what you're being paid for lending actual money. And that's not the way von Bawerk thought about it. He thought fundamentally the way interest manifests itself in a market economy is it's a return to the capitalists for deploying their capital, but the way it manifests itself primarily, he thought, is not from the capitalists selling their capital goods for money and then lending that money to somebody else and contractually drawing up a loan document and saying, okay, I'm going to give you 1,000 ounces of gold today, and then next year you're going to pay me back 1,050, so that's an interest rate of 5%. That's not the way von Bawerk thought about interest. What he thought about interest was the capitalists invest in producer goods and set them to work producing goods of lower order, which then can be sold for money in the future. And at that point, the capitalists, if they've correctly anticipated things, receive more gross revenues than what their monetary expenses were up front. So again, the capitalists start out and they have a bunch of money, and they could consume it. You know, they could go spend it on steaks and operas and so forth, but they don't. Instead, they invest it. So they buy things like, they hire workers, they buy raw materials, they buy other capital goods, and then they have an operation going that's going to produce goods for sale down the road. And when those things are sold, they get money for them, obviously, because it's the money economy. And the point is, they typically get taken more total money than what they spent out of pocket in the past when they first bought those resources or those inputs. And so that is where the gross return comes from. And so that's what I mean here on this PowerPoint, this first point, when I say interest is due to the price spread, or what we might call the markup, between goods of higher order and goods of lower order. So that terminology, just to refresh your memory, is coming from Menger, where the lowest order good, the first order good, is the consumer good. So that's like the sliced loaf of bread in the packaging sitting on the shelf at the grocery store. And then the higher order goods are when you move further away from that final retail good to the factors of production that preceded it. So you might call the second order good, or second order goods might include things like the unsliced loaf of bread at the baker's, and then the labor of the guy who has to drive the truck to bring, you know, that loaf of bread to the grocery store, and so on. So in other words, second order goods are those things that are needed in various combinations to produce a first order good. And then you say, okay, where did that loaf of bread come? So that wholesale loaf of bread that's, you know, not cut up yet, that's sitting in the baker's oven, if that's a second order good, well then what might be a third order good? Well, maybe that's the flour that, you know, the miller produces, because the flour is an input into producing, you know, the baker needs the flour in order just to make the wholesale loaf of bread before it gets sliced up. Okay, so you see how that works. So the point is, if you divide a given production process into these various stages, von Bawerk is saying, you know, the way he conceives of interest is looking at the price spreads between each stage. So it's a crucial point. People often think, before they really study economics carefully, they kind of think that if competition is allowed to work, that over time in a mature, stable industry, that the cost of production will equal the price of the finished goods. And that's actually not true, if you think about it. If that were true, if it meant that, you know, if you were going to sell a product for $1,000 and it took like a year to produce it, if it were the case that all things considered you had to spend roughly $1,000 making it, well, that would be silly then. Why would anybody get into that industry? Instead, so, you know, if you had to tie up your $1,000 for a year hiring workers and paying the rent on the factory and buying raw materials and so forth to produce something that you could only sell to the final customer for $1,000, you'd be making a 0% return on your money as the investor. So why would you do that? You would just be getting your money back. You would do better to go lend it, you know, to buy a bond with it, or to, you know, put it in the bank where you're earning some interest. Okay, so that's the idea. So again, just to repeat that, von Bawerk and then Mises following him and Rothbard and so forth, when they think of interest, they don't think of it in terms of contractual loan interest. They think of it as being determined in the market for factors of production, and specifically the markups or the price spreads between various stages. So if there is if the rate of interest is established there, then that's going to, of course, have to be matched in the contractual loan market once we adjust for differences of the risk involved. Right? It can't be that you can earn a 15% return on your money by buying factors of production in the fourth order of the bread chain and then selling, you know, the third order goods, you can't earn 15% there, but only earn 2% buying factors at the second order level and then selling the finished loaves of bread, because then capitalists would just shift around and divert their funds to where the rate of return is the highest. Again, if we abstract away from potential differences in the risk involved. Right, so in equilibrium, the rate of return on your money per unit of time should be the same, at least if we abstract away from risk. Okay, second main point for Bombavrik is that once you conceive of the interest phenomenon in that way, and so you'll realize that what's going on with interest is that in a sense, the cumulative amount of money you have to spend on all the various factors of production necessary to make a finished product is less than the gross revenue that you expect to receive from selling that product. Once you understand that that's what interest is, or that's the source of interest, then it paves the way for how you can explain this phenomenon. Like, why should the rate of interest be positive? Why is it possible for capitalists to regularly earn a return on their investment? So one of the leading explanations when Bombavrik was first writing and contributing to this literature was to say, well, what, you know, why is it that capital seems to earn a return? Well, duh, it's because capital is productive, right? I mean, why does labor earn a return? Because it's productive. You can make more stuff if you add more workers, and so that's where wages come from. There's no mystery there. And so now we're saying the capitalists come along and they have control over capital goods and they contribute to the production process. We can make more stuff with capital than without. And so, you know, isn't it just a marginal productivity explanation? On the margin, you put one more unit of capital into the mix, output goes up, and so that difference is the return to capital. So interest is the return to capital, just like wages are the return to labor. Wage rates are determined by marginal productivity, so isn't that what interest is determined by? What's the big deal? And if you go on to grad school, or for those of you who are in grad school right now and study economics at that level, and you do mathematical models, you'll do that, right? You have a production function that, you know, y equals some function of k and l, right? Where y is total output, and k is capital, and l is labor. And how do you solve in that kind of mathematical framework? How do you solve for the equilibrium wage rate? Well, you take the derivative of f with respect to L. And then how do you solve for the equilibrium interest rate? Oh, you take the derivative of f with respect to k. Right. So anyway, I'm getting a little bit too technical here, but that's very misleading. And this goes back to Bombavrik. He really put his finger on why that's misleading. So it's not that it's wrong in these mathematical models. I mean, the math is correct. It's not like the calculus is wrong. But the principles involved and what mainstream economists think that model is saying is wrong. So the economics they're deriving from it are bad, but the math is correct. All right. But back to Bombavrik, he put his finger on what's wrong with that approach. He said, no, the return to the productivity of capital that's analogous to wage rates being the return to the productivity of labor is an interest. It's the rental price of a capital. Right? So if there's a tractor and the farmer can use the tractor and get more crops, that explains why he would be willing to pay such and such to rent the tractor for a day or for an hour or whatever. Just like by hiring one more migrant laborer, if he could have more crops picked, that would explain how much the owner of the farm would be willing to pay to hire the worker for one more hour. But interest is a percentage, or the interest rate is a percentage. And the absolute interest earnings has to do not with how productive something is, but rather with its apparent undervaluation. So again, to understand the interest problem, if you're a capitalist and you have a bunch of money and you're going to go and buy a tractor and then use that in your operation, yes, you can, you're going to be able to sell more crops because of that than if you didn't buy the tractor. But the problem is, as Bauer pointed out, to understand interest, that you need more information than that. The reason you can earn interest, the reason you ultimately recoup more total money from selling those crops, having bought the tractor, is that for some reason the initial purchase price of the tractor is lower than the long run boost to your revenues that the tractor will make possible. Everyone see that? So if the tractor initially costs $50,000, and so you have your capital in the term in the form of money, and you buy the $50,000 tractor, and then you use it for the next 10 years, and your yields are higher because of it, and so you get more money because you're selling more crops, great. But the only way you're earning an interest return on your $50,000 investment is if you ultimately collect, if your revenues are raised by more than $50,000 relative to what they otherwise would have been. That's the only way that you can make your initial $50,000 turn into more than $50,000 over time. So what Bauer is saying, the brute technological fact that you can grow more crops with the tractor than without does not explain interest. If anything, it just underscores what the mystery is, right? Because to understand interest, what we're really trying to do is to say, why is it that the tractor, that the price I have to pay right now for the tractor is less than what I forecast this tractor is going to ultimately be worth to me in terms of boosting my revenues over time? That's the only way I earn interest, is if I have to pay less for the tractor than what it's ultimately going to do for me. And so Bombaverick says, to answer that odd result, or to explain that odd result, it's no good to say, oh, the tractor's productive. That's the whole point. It seems like we're not taking adequate account of its productivity when we think about what interest is and the essence of interest. Okay, so Bombaverick says, the true explanation for the existence of interest is that, as a general rule, people value present goods more highly than future goods. So if you want to think of it in terms of real goods, right now, if you have enough money to be able to buy 1,000 bushels of wheat and you're going to use those funds to invest in a tractor, ultimately, over time, that tractor is going to yield you more than 1,000 bushels of an increment in your harvest. In reality, the number would probably be way higher than that, but we'll just keep it at 1,000. Right, so maybe over the next 10 years, you're actually going to reap 1,100 bushels of wheat more than you would without having bought the tractor. So in a sense, what you're doing is you're transforming your initial command over 1,000 bushels of wheat, right? Because we said, imagine you had enough money up front that if you went out and bought wheat that day, you could get 1,000 bushels worth. You're trading that away, in a sense, for a claim on future wheat, because the tractor physically is going to allow you to have more wheat in the future than you otherwise would. So it's like you're trading your ability to have 1,000 bushels of wheat in the present for a stream of wheat delivered over time into the future. And because there's a positive interest rate in that implicit price structure, what's happening is present bushels of wheat trade at a premium compared to future bushels of wheat. And Bombaverick says, once you start thinking of the interest problem like that, the mystery goes away. Now we just have to explain why is it, using subjective value theory, that people in equilibrium tend to value one unit of present goods more highly than one unit of the same good that's not available until the future? And if that is the case, well, then it just pops out that there would be a positive interest rate. Because really what you're doing when you're a capitalist and you invest in inputs today is you're trading away your potential consumption today of present goods, and you're buying claims, technological claims, on future goods. And so if there's that premium that you can totally explain, not with reference to technology and productivity, but just in terms of subjective valuation, you know, I say to the consumer, hey, do you want one apple today, or do you want me to give you this airtight claim to one apple that won't be delivered for 5 years? Most people are going to say, give me the apple today. And so if I just think about it from a different angle, if I say, how much would you be willing to pay for an apple right now, and how much would you be willing to pay right now for an apple that won't be delivered in 5 years, you'd be willing to pay more for the present apple than you would for the claim to the future apple. And so once you understand that, and it doesn't take thinking about tractors producing more physical apples and stuff like that, no, just it's time preference. If that makes sense to you, well then boom, you just solve the interest problem. Given that that's the price structure, if you just think it through, it necessarily follows that somebody who invests in factors of production today that will yield consumption goods down the road can transform command over a smaller amount of consumption goods today into command over a larger number of consumption goods down the road. Okay, now this last point, subsistence fund. This is a little more controversial. What do I mean by that? We don't talk about this too much in modern Austrian economics because there are a lot of problems with this fund, with this concept, I should say. And we can do everything we want to do with Austrian capital and interest theory without really using this concept anymore. But Mises uses it a lot in Chapter 19, so you kind of have to know what he's talking about. And also, just to be clear, Mises says early on in Chapter 19 in a footnote something along the lines of, I'm going to be constantly using the Bombaverkian framework here to express my views on the trade cycle, and the reader shouldn't construe that as my total endorsement of von Bawerk's framework. It's not the place right now for me to go off on my disagreements with von Bawerk on these issues. And since he's kind of the pioneer in this and everybody knows his framework and it's good enough for what I want to get across, for now, let's just assume von Bawerk's basic framework is correct and I'll illustrate my views within that framework. But Mises is acknowledging even at this point that he doesn't fully endorse everything von Bawerk has written on capital and interest. Okay, but anyway, what is this term subsistence fund? Here I'm going to have to be brief because we do have the clock to consider. So the idea is, what the capitalists do, they abstain from present consumption. Right? So the capitalists, they have the ability, if they wanted to, if they didn't want to save, if they just consumed all their wealth, they could have a big blowout. They could have an orgy of consumption, if you will. But they don't. What they end up doing is they defer their consumption to the future. And in terms of the physical mechanics of it, so how is it that a capitalist who has the ability right now, because he has control over financial means, money, or he has things that he could sell for money and then use the money to go buy consumption goods, right? So the capitalist has the financial ability right now to consume a lot, but he chooses not to, Instead, he invests those funds. So from his perspective, he's saving and investing. And then that yields him a flow of income over time that ultimately allows for more total consumption than if he were to just have a big blowout up front. So physically, what's going on? How is this possible? How does this all fit together from a macro perspective? And Von Bobrick says, well, what's happening is the capitalists, when they abstain from consumption, in a sense, it's like they've accumulated a bunch of present goods. Like, just picture them as literally having accumulated a bunch of tuna fish and a bunch of sweaters and a bunch of water and a bunch of electricity and wood for housing and stuff like that, right? So they have all these present goods. I don't even say wood for housing, like actual houses, right? The capitalists have accumulated all of this stuff that can be enjoyed in the present, and instead of the capitalists enjoying their own property and consuming it, instead of them going into these apartments that they've accumulated over time and having dance parties and sleeping until 5 at night, whatever, they instead let the workers enjoy all that stuff. Right? So they give the food to the workers. The workers get to live in the apartments and the houses and so on, to drive around in the fancy cars, to go watch movies and eat steak dinners. And in exchange, the workers sell their labor to the capitalists. And so what the capitalists have done is they've exchanged all these present goods for future goods, because now the capitalists own the goods that are in process, right? Because the workers keep working on stuff that's eventually going to yield other goods down the road, right? So right now we have all these goods that were developed in the past, right? So if there's a house here that's ready to go, it's a finished house, that was built by workers and other inputs in the past. And right now it's ready to be enjoyed. So what the capitalists do, like I say, instead of them going into the house and living there, instead they say, well, I own this house, but you know what? I'll let the workers come live in it and enjoy its services, its flow of shelter services right now. But you start building a new house, right? So in the beginning, you know, you guys start digging out the foundation, and then you guys start pouring the concrete for the basement, and you guys start cutting down trees, and you guys start, you know, turning those tree trunks into boards that we're going to ultimately use, right? So they get the process, they get the ball rolling, so at some point down in the future, there's going to be another house that's ready. So that's the deal, that in a capitalistic society, at any given time, a large portion of what the workers are working on are future goods, right? It's not stuff that's going to immediately give utility to anybody. It's stuff that's going to be very useful in terms of consumption down the road. But the thing is that if the capitalists all of a sudden just withdrew from society, or if they consumed all their stuff, the workers would be in serious trouble, because the workers they haven't accumulated anything. The worker says, hey, I'm hungry right now. I'm willing to, you know, hey, does somebody want to hire me to dig a foundation, but let me live in an apartment right now, or to give me pizza right now? You know, I'll start, picking the wheat that's going to be used to make the flour and so on, make the dough for pizza. Do you use wheat for pizza? I don't know. See, I'm showing my ignorance. Okay, but the point is, I want to eat the pizza right now. So somebody who's willing to give me pizza now, and I'll be happy to do the work that will create two pizzas 3 years from now. Does everyone see how that works? So what the workers want to do is they want somebody to advance them. Sort of like an advance. It's like, you know, like a payday, advance payday loan thing, where, you know, someone's going to give you somebody owes you a bunch of money. You do a job for your employer, and you're going to get the paycheck at the end of the month, but you need to eat now, so you go to these payday lenders and they give you an advance. Well, in a sense, that's what the capitalists do even with the actual paycheck, right? Because what the workers are doing, like if you're building a house and you dig the foundation, that foundation per se isn't useful to anybody. It's a hole in the ground. What the heck are you going to do with that? But it's, it starts the ball rolling. Oh, now you're that much closer to having a finished house, which is useful. And so that's what in the Bamberkian framework, that's what the capitalists do, is they are the ones who accumulate this subsistence fund. It's what keeps the workers alive while we wait for their efforts to mature into now present goods. And so when you try to, so the more developed and capitalistic a society becomes, the higher the proportion of inputs at any given time that are going into future goods, as opposed to that are just putting the finishing touches on goods that are now available for immediate consumption, right? So the reason that works is Bumbauer thinks empirically, the longer the process of production, what he calls the more roundabout the production process, the more physically productive it is. So if you have an hour of labor you're going to devote to some task, if you devote it to a task that won't yield its fruits for 10 years, the quantity of consumption goods that your hour of labor will yield 10 years from now is going to be higher than if you only devote yourself to some project that will yield the finished consumption good in 5 years or in 1 year. And that's not a law of the human mind, that's just an empirical regularity that Bumbauer thought was pretty well established. So a different way of saying it is, if you have a longer time frame to work with, you can discover ways to amplify the physical output of a given input of some factor of production, whether it's an hour of labor or a bushel of wheat or acre of farmland or whatever. Okay, so that's the idea. All right, we gotta keep moving here. Last thing, so that's why the capitalists earn interest, because what they're doing is they are advancing present goods to the workers, and the workers are effectively giving them the claims on the future goods that the workers are helping to create. And so because it trades at a premium, that's why the capitalists, since they're willing to abstain from consumption, can then earn a flow of consumption over time that exceeds what they could have had if they just consumed it all up front. Okay, the implications of this. So what, and when I say of this, I mean of Mises asking about the money relation and its effect on consumer producer goods. So what Mises is saying, therefore, is he wants to see if changes in the supply of and demand for money, if they affect consumer and producer good prices to the same extent. And then notice that that's actually equivalent to saying, can the banks lower the rate of interest by issuing fiduciary media? So at first, I'm looking to slide B now. Point one and point two seem like they have very little to do with each other. But actually, when you understand the various Austrian views on things, you see that actually they're the same question. Or if you answer one of them, then you know the answer to the other. Because the banks, by issuing fiduciary media, we already have seen, affect the quantity of money. And then if you believe that the banks, by issuing fiduciary media, can push down the rate of interest, well, then what you must be saying is the banks, by issuing fiduciary media, can reduce the markup and the spread between prices of various orders, right? Because if the bank loan rate of interest goes from 5% to 3%, then it has to be the case that the markup between the factors required to produce fourth order goods, third order goods, and so on, that spread has to go from 5% down to 3% too, because through arbitrage and so forth, they got to be the same. Okay, the big debate. Mises refers to this again and again throughout the book. The two English schools of thought regarding banking. So the banking school people, including Tooke and Fullerton, they thought the banks couldn't affect prices really because, in their view, the banks were sort of impotent. The banks really didn't have the power to expand the quantity of money because the banking school people thought that, I see a question, yeah, fiduciary media means it's a money substitute that's not backed up by actual money in the narrower sense in the vault. So it's when a bank makes a loan that's unbacked. Okay, so the banking school thought that the banks really couldn't affect prices because, yeah, they might try to issue more fiduciary media, but if the community didn't want to hold it, they thought it would quickly return to the banks. They thought the merchants and the community needed a certain quantity of money for the needs of commerce, and if the banks tried to expand and inject more money than the community wanted to hold, then it would just come right back to the banks. The currency school thought that no, the quantity of credit that the business community wanted was not independent of the interest rate, or to put it without using a double negative, was dependent on the interest rate. So that's, Mises says, that was the great mistake of the banking school, is they just thought of, well, gee, how much credit, how many loans or how much money in terms of loans do the business community want to borrow? And of course, you can't answer that question in a vacuum. It depends what the interest rate is. At a lower rate of interest, other things equal, the business community will want to borrow more. So the banks they do have the power to issue more money by issuing more fiduciary media, so long as they are willing to lower the interest rate they charge on those loans. Okay, slide 3, money and interest. Okay, in the long run, the classical writers, people like David Hume and Adam Smith, they showed, just to sort of get people warmed up here to start thinking about this, they showed there's no direct relationship between the quantity of money and the interest rate. So just think about it. Like, originally, you got a certain amount of money, and the interest rate is 5%. Okay? Now, they double the quantity of money. What happens in the long run? Well, in the long run, neglecting issues about distributional effects and so on, all prices double, right? That's to a first approximation, that's what happens. So something that cost $100 before now costs $200 because of the doubling of the quantity of money. But if the interest rate originally was 5%, does that mean now in the new equilibrium the interest rate is going to be 10%? And the answer is no. You just think it through, you would expect the interest rate to be 5%. Again, at least from a direct impact of doubling the quantity of money. I can't spend too much time on that, but just think through that. If that sounds wrong to you, if your intuition would say, well, no, so if something originally were $20, we double the quantity of money, so now, without really knowing much else about the situation, my best guess is that this thing would now cost $40. And so originally, a banker to lend me money would charge 5%, but now I think he would charge 10% in the new equilibrium. If that's the way you're thinking, then your intuition's wrong. And so you try to just think through the logic of that and see why it's wrong. To give you some hints, think of it this way. What you're doing when you borrow money or lend money is you're renting the use of the money. That might be one way to think about it. So you might think, well, wait a minute, the money that I'm borrowing in the new equilibrium now isn't worth as much, right? Because all prices have doubled. So the money that I'm borrowing, if I, you know, before if I were borrowing $100 and I'm going to pay 5% interest, then I would pay $5 to borrow the $100. But now in the new equilibrium, that $100 isn't worth as much to me. And so, you know, that might affect how much I'd be willing to pay to borrow it. But notice how much the money that you're paying to borrow it is also similarly changed in value too. So that's kind of the way to think about it, that whatever your intuition is to tell you that that interest rate, either from the borrower's or the lender's viewpoint, should be different because now the money's not worth as much, just keep in mind that it cuts both ways. That, yeah, the amount you're borrowing is now, in a sense, cut in half in real terms, but then the amount that you're paying in interest is also cut in half in real terms. So those things kind of cancel out, and that's why the interest rate, which is a percentage, is, again, if you're going to make your best guess, it would be unchanged. Now, having said that, what I just talked about was a direct effect. But changes in the quantity of money, as we know, in reality, can redistribute wealth. So they can indirectly affect the equilibrium interest rate if it just so happens that because of this magical doubling of the quantity of money, maybe on net, wealth gets redistributed from people who tend not to save very much into the hands of people who tend to save a lot. So now, in general, there's more saving in society in real terms. And that might push down the interest rate. So maybe now the interest rate is, instead of being 5%, is 4%. Or going the other way, if for whatever reason we double the quantity of money, if the people who reacted first before prices adjusted were the people who were prodigals and spendthrifts, then, you know, they gained relatively to the other people who were caught flat-footed, the savers. And so maybe there was a redistribution of wealth as we moved to the new equilibrium in prices from the savers into the pockets of the people who went out and consumed it. And so it's possible now when things settle down and prices generally have doubled that the new equilibrium interest rate might be 6% or 7%. Not because of the doubling of the money per se, but because of the change in the distribution of wealth out of the savers and into the hands of the non-savers. Okay. In the short run, Mises points out, so what I just talked about was the long-run impact on the interest rate from changes in the supply of and demand for money. In the short run, though, Mises says, while the price system is adjusting to a disturbance coming from the money side, you do have this impact on the interest rate. From the fact that typically entrepreneurs, how does he put it? In our modern terminology, what Mises is getting at here is that prices tend to be stickier for wage earners than for the entrepreneur. The entrepreneur is able to, the prices of the goods that the entrepreneur sells to his customers tend to change more rapidly than what the entrepreneur has to pay, for example, to his workers. So if you're in an environment where prices in general are rising because, let's say, the quantity of money has increased, so there's price inflation, all prices don't magically rise at the same percentage. What actually happens is that at first, in response to this influx of new money, you will see product prices rise and then wages will lag behind it. So during that adjustment period, the entrepreneurs benefit, because they're earning higher revenues but their costs of production haven't caught up yet. And so now the entrepreneurs are benefiting. There's like a wealth redistribution into the hands of the entrepreneurs. So they want to expand their operations. And so they try to borrow more from the banks. And so that means, so it goes the other way. So that would push up the interest rate. And it's the other way around. If you're in an environment where prices are falling, the entrepreneurs are taking it on the chin because their revenues are dropping, but they can't just immediately pass that on by cutting wages for their workers. There's a bit of a lag. So their profit margins shrink, if you want to use that terminology. And so they're going to borrow less from the banks. That's going to depress the rate of interest. So anyway, so that's why I've written the slide I have. Okay, banks and interest. Mises talks about this phrase a lot called the gratuitous nature of credit. And here what he means is that from an administrative point of view, if you're just looking at a bank in isolation, you just say, how does it operate? If we assume it's a bank that's in good standing with the community, people in the community use its fiduciary media, then what's to stop that bank from just issuing more and more of that stuff and pushing down the rate of interest? And now at some point, he says, the bank is actually going to start losing money, right? Because it actually does cost something to have the employees, you have the overhead. If you're printing up actual bank notes, I mean, you have to pay for the ink and the paper and pay the artist to make sure, whatever. So it's not literally free to run a commercial bank. So the point is that the rate of interest can't literally get pushed down to zero, at least for the bank to be able to stay in business. But the point is the bank can clearly push the rate of interest down pretty low if we're just looking at the technical, you know, what would stop it from doing that? And so now the question is, suppose the banks do that, and that's what I mean by the gratuitous nature of credit. It seems like they can grant credit gratuitously, that there's nothing checking it. There's no penalty. And so, but the point is, surely there must be. So what would happen to restore equilibrium? So here Mises relies on the framework of Wicksell, and it's sort of like his use of Bumbaverk here, that he doesn't endorse everything from Wicksell, but he builds upon it. So that, again, just to see what Mises did here. It's not that Mises was just in a corner and out of the clear blue sky, you know, out of the brow of Zeus, developed a circulation trade credit theory or circulation credit theory of the trade cycle. Instead, he read everything that seemed like human history that had been written about the subject, and he took the stuff that he thought was useful, and then he weeded out the parts of each person's presentation that he thought wasn't quite right, and then unified it into a coherent theory that had never been presented in quite that way before. So from Wicksell, Mises gets these ideas of, or this distinction between the natural rate of interest and the money rate of interest. So the natural rate is the rate of interest that would prevail if people didn't use money, if they just directly traded capital goods against each other, or capital goods for consumption goods and so on. That's the implicit rate of interest that would emerge from that sort of economy. And so the idea is if there were more savings and the proportion of capital goods increased compared to consumption goods, you probably expect the rate of interest to go down and so on. All right. So it's like the real factors that determine the equilibrium interest rate. The money rate of interest is just like it sounds. That's the actual, what we might nowadays call the nominal rate of interest in the actual loan market. So it's how much the banks contractually charge you when they lend you money. So the point is, in that framework, if the commercial banks issue fiduciary media, expand the quantity of money, at least temporarily, they're going to push the money rate of interest below what the natural rate is. And so Mises is now asking, what forces, if any, come into play to counteract that? Is there anything that is like a negative feedback cycle that causes the money rate of interest to rise back up to the natural rate? All right, on page 362, Mises has a quick but a very useful description of what we now refer to as an unsustainable boom. So here's what Mises says. Despite the fact that there has been no increase of intermediate products, a rate of interest is established in the loan market, which corresponds to a longer period of production. And so a lengthening of the period of production promises for the time to be profitable. A time must necessarily come when the means of subsistence available for consumption are all used up, although the capital goods employed in production have not yet been transformed into consumption goods. Okay, so that's a little bit obscure, but it's like I say, that is where Mises is talking about what we now would call an unsustainable boom. So let me, and this is why it was necessary to lay the foundation of the Bombeverkian framework, and you kind of have to know what Mises is talking about here with the subsistence fund and with the periods of production and so on. All right, so let me circle back here and make sense of this quote, because this is crucial. In the Bombeverkian framework, remember, so I laid out about half an hour ago, the function of the capitalists is they accumulate the subsistence fund. And then they advance those, so it's a big stockpile of various types of consumption goods. Just think of it that way. And instead of them eating it, you know, instead of them drinking all that beer and eating all that pizza and driving all those sports cars around and living in all those different apartment buildings, they advance those goods to the workers. And also to, it's not just to the workers. It's also they advance it to the owners of other factors of production. So they also advance it to the guy who owns a bunch of timber land, right? So there's a guy, he owns a bunch of land. Maybe it's been in his family for a long time, and it's a forest. And so periodically, you know, crews go through and they saw down some trees, cart it off, and start, you know, turning into wood pulp and blah, 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 and a few years from now, it's a bunch of notepads. But the guy who owns that, right now, he's about to go to Mises University, and he wants a notepad right now. So it does, you know, it's no good to him to say, well, no, if you just wait 3 years, you can turn one of your trees into a notepad. He's the, I don't want to wait 3 years. I'm going to Mises U next week. I need the notepad now. I'm packing my stuff. I'm getting in the car, making the trek down to Auburn, Alabama. I need a notepad right now. I know that my ownership of these trees is like a technological claim on future notepads, but I want a present notepad. So now the capitalist comes along and says, oh, it just so happens I own a present notepad. See, it's right here. So I'll tell you what. I will trade you this notepad now, and you trade me some of your trees. And actually, if you ran the numbers, you would see that what you're trading me is the equivalent of two notepads. that will be available 5 years from now. And so, yeah, in a sense, you're getting ripped off. I'm exploiting you, but really it's just because present goods are more valuable than future goods. You would rather have a present notepad than a future notepad. So I'm making you this offer. I will trade you this present notepad, but in exchange, I want you to give me control over the timber that you own right now. And then I'm going to use it, and I'm going to start a production process of making future notepads. Okay, so it's not just the workers. It's also it's all the owners of factors of production. The capitalists advance present goods to all them because they don't want to wait. Yeah, they have the technological ability to create consumption goods and services, but they won't be ready anytime soon. They want to end. So the owners of these inputs want to consume now. And so that's what the capitalists do. They give them an advance, but they charge a premium. And that's why the capitalists can regularly earn a net return on their investments. That over time, they can consume off the top of their wealth, and yet the principal doesn't shrink. They can just keep, you know, they can keep doing that bargain year after year. Every year they can go up to that guy and give him a notepad and then get a claim to more than one future notepad. And so over time, on net, their wealth is accumulating, or they can consume a certain amount year after year, and they don't all, you know, and they don't run out of wealth. So that's what's going on there. It's because of that premium they're charging. Okay. So now, if you just think through that conception, that framework, if the capitalists start saving more and more, right, so the amount of their gross income that they could consume, instead they abstain, and so over time that subsistence fund grows larger and larger. And so that will allow the workers to engage in longer projects. So now instead of taking that wood pulp, or taking that tree and devoting it to a process that will yield notepads in 3 years, now they say, well, you know, it would be more physically productive if we disregard time. I can take that same tree and put it into a process that will yield 4 notepads instead of 2 or 3 or whatever number I said, but we'll have to wait 8 years. Okay, so the bigger the subsistence fund, now society, in a sense, can afford to take the inputs of the factor owners, the workers, the people who own the natural resources and so on, and devote them into longer and longer projects. And so the payoff is, once those things mature, once those longer projects reach their fruition or come to their fruition, now we've got, you know, the consumption goods shooting out of those longer pipelines. You get more of it per unit of what you put in. So if you can just get over that hump of that longer lead time, your standard of living rises, right? So if you can just get into that longer cycle, now the workers are enjoying more notepads and more pizzas and whatever per hour of labor that they're willing to sell to the capitalists. So you see there's that transition period. If we're trying to move from one recurring pattern into one that involves a longer wait time, there's that gap there, and it takes savings to expand the subsistence fund to now cover that longer lead time. And so how do you coordinate all this stuff in practice? Well, the Austrians think that's what the interest rate is crucial for, that when the capitalists save a lot more and so now the subsistence fund is bigger, that means society, in a sense, can afford to invest more of its resources in the longer-term projects. But for specific individual enterprises, specific entrepreneurs, obviously they're not socialist central planners. They don't know in the grand scheme of things, well, gee, how long is the average period of production? They don't know that stuff. All they know is, I'm thinking about building a factory here that's going to take wood pulp in and produce notepads and da-da-da-da, and then, you know, looking at your factory in relation to everything else in that industry, what ends up happening is if you look at the thing from a God's eye perspective, you would see, oh, now what they're doing is they're chopping down trees and then sending that down a process of production where each worker and other people come and work on it a little bit and transform it bit by bit. So now it takes 8 years to go from that raw tree in the forest to the notepads, but you get more total notepads per tree doing it this way. But the point is, each little enterprise that's involved in that long-term project process doesn't see the big picture. And so market prices have to be such to tell entrepreneurs when it's profitable to get into those industries, and such that when everyone's doing the right thing, when everyone's doing what is profitable, it leads to this result that we go from being, you know, from having industries that turn trees into notepads over the course of 3 years, and instead they take 8 years to take a given tree and turn it into notepads. So the point is, it's the interest rate that helps coordinate that adjustment to make that transition. So what Mises is saying here, what happens when the interest rate is falling, and in a sense giving the green light to entrepreneurs to engage in longer term projects, not because the actual subsistence fund really is bigger, but just because the banks printed up a bunch more banknotes, and that's why the interest rate fell. Well, now we're in trouble, because now resources that previously would have been devoted to shorter term projects, so they would have, so the workers and the wood pulp and whatever would have been working on stuff that would have yielded notepads and pizzas and steaks and cars, let's say 3 years from now. Now they've all been redirected. Their efforts have been redeployed into projects that won't yield notepads and cars and pizzas and steaks until 8 years from now. But the subsistence fund actually isn't any bigger. So the point is, 3 years are going to go by, and now we're going to be out of pizzas and steak and notepad, and we're still going to be 5 years away from getting the reinforcements or the replenishment of that subsistence fund. Okay, I gotta move on because of time constraints, but I'm hoping I'm getting the gist of this across to you guys. And Mises points out, I don't have it quoted here, but right in this section, Mises points out that in the real world economy, thank goodness, it's not like all of the different processes overlap, right? So it's not that when the artificially low interest rate gets all the entrepreneurs out of whack and they start investing in longer term projects than what the subsistence fund is available to tide us over until they're finished. That was a terrible sentence. It's not that actually everything's going fine and then all of a sudden after the 3 years go up, all consumption goods are gone, because then we'd all starve and that would be it. Humanity would perish. Mises says it's more of a relative thing that, you know, as the boom progresses and we start running out of this and this and this and these other projects haven't yet yielded their final consumption goods, that the flow of consumption goods starts shrinking, or at least it's not rising as fast as people thought it was going to. But it's not like it goes from being full blast to nothing. It's just that it starts shrinking. And again, it might even be just a shrinking in terms of relative to what we thought, so growing more slowly than people had anticipated. But it's not like it's just an all or nothing thing. And so that's when the crisis really starts setting in. Okay, so how is the natural rate restored? Well, when the crisis finally hits, what happens? At that point, people are scrambling for consumption goods, and so their prices rise relative to the prices of production goods. So just think through that example I was working with, and of course I exaggerated the numbers, but if everybody thought, oh, we're in this new equilibrium where the standard of living is much higher, we're just a lot richer right now, that my labor is in a sense being, because it's like this, the entrepreneurs now are acting and they're paying workers as if their labor is now being invested in an 8-year project, which physically will yield more notepads. You know, so now the trees are being, each tree is invested in a pipeline that will shoot out, whatever I said, I'm forgetting the numbers, 5 notepads instead of 2. So now people are going to be using notepads to make paper airplanes. They're going to be using notepads like crazy because, in a sense, it's like we have 2.5 times more notepads now because the productivity of our trees has just gone up by a bunch because now we're going to, the flow of finished notepad we're going to get from our given acreage of forest is now going to be permanently higher because we think we've transitioned to a new arrangement where each tree on average is in this pipeline of production for a lot longer. And given that now we can technically pick a process that's more physically productive. So it's, and it's the same thing with all the labor. So no, we feel richer. And so we're consuming a lot more. But then 3 years into it, because we actually didn't have more consumer goods for the capitalists to advance to the workers and the other resource owners, we're going to hit a brick wall. Uh-oh, we're out of notepads. Wait a minute, I thought we were swimming in notepads. Well, we were in our head. And if we wait another 5 years, then those notepads are going to come shooting out the pipeline. But right now we're out. Uh-oh. So the price of notepads now goes to the roof compared to what we thought they were going to be. And the people who are in the notepad production industry are they're not going to be continuing and trying to produce notepads. They're going to be ready 5 years from now. They're going to revamp their operations and try to crank out notepads now, because now there's an urgent need for notepads. And so you can see, so the prices of lower order goods are going to shoot way up, whereas the prices of the higher order goods, you know, so the price of a tree might actually go down at this point, because everyone's like, a tree doesn't really help me right now. We've got a bunch of stuff in the pipeline that's going to yield a bunch of notepads 5 years from now. So I really don't need to be buying more trees to throw it into that pipeline. We have a glut there. The crucial thing we need right now is I need a notepad today. I need a notepad tomorrow and the next week. So let me go bid up prices of stuff that can quickly be turned into notepads, even if it's through a very inefficient process, if you will, but where time is of the essence. So you can see how in that new, when that shock hits everybody, the relative prices of different orders of goods will change, with a huge premium being given to present goods and, you know, second order and third order goods, whereas eighth and ninth and 15th order goods, nobody wants them right. Nobody's buying those things right now, so their prices are going to plummet. So in terms of the price spreads, what does that mean? That now all of a sudden the interest rate has risen, that the markup between higher order goods and lower order goods now is much bigger. And that's what Mises means by saying the natural rate now gets restored. The other thing too is that issue of when there's a transition period, because of this influx of more and more fiduciary media, the purchasing power of money is falling. And so that gives an advantage to the entrepreneurs to bid up the interest rate. Finally, Mises says, look, if for some reason the banks just buried their heads in the sand and just kept pumping in more and more fiduciary media, limited only by the expenses of actually printing up the banknotes and so on, and, you know, paying the bank employees to maintain all that stuff, ultimately, you would just have a runaway inflation, right? That the purchasing power of money would fall to zero, ultimately. And then, in that sense, the interest rate would rise too. Okay, the last slide here. The question is, who or what is responsible for the onset of the crisis. So let me read the quote and then I'll elaborate. So this is Mises from page 365. He says, banks, quote, have always left off long before reaching this limit, meaning where the currency just collapses, whether because of growing uneasiness on their own part or whether because they had to defer to legislative regulations. And so the crises broke out before they need have broken out. Certainly, the banks would be able to postpone the collapse, but nevertheless, the moment must eventually come when no further extension of the circulation of fiduciary media is possible. Then the catastrophe occurs. Okay, so I took some stuff out here, and you can see that with the ellipses, just to make it fit on the slide, but this whole passage, you know, the longer version is really good. So let me just make sure you get what Mises is saying here. You got to recall that when Mises is writing, and even to this day, there were people whom he would call monetary cranks that thought the scarcity was artificial, but it was imposed by the system, and that if the banks would just freely lend, pushing interest rates down to virtually zero, that we would have untold prosperity. And it was just, you know, the machinations of the evil bankers who were artificially causing scarcity by restricting their lending that was, so that they could gain a relative advantage. And that there was nothing, that the rate of interest that obviously in any individual enterprise was a constraint, right? For anything you're trying to do as a business person, if the interest rate is lower, you have more options. And so various writers thought there's something bad about high interest rates, that they seem to impose scarcity on us when, gee, if the interest rate were just lower, businesses could produce more stuff. They'd hire more workers, have more output. Why wouldn't everybody want to have lower interest rates? So they didn't think that there was something real lying behind the interest rate. So what Mises is getting at here is he's saying, they are right when they, when these people say. So historically, what happens? There's a boom. Everything seems great. Everyone's got a job. Unemployment's really low. Workers feel rich. Business profits are rising. Everything seems great. And then, for some reason, the banks start panicking, and they cut back on their issue of fiduciary media. Right, they stop injecting so much fiduciary media, or they actively restrict their granting of new credit, and so interest rates rise, and all of a sudden a bunch of businesses are caught flat-footed. Oh no, at these higher interest rates, we can't continue with this project. So they lay off workers, some of them go out of business altogether, and the economy crashes. Bunch of bankruptcies, massive unemployment, production actually goes down. And so people looking at the situation said, what the heck? Why did the bankers do that? If the bankers just would keep the good times going and keep interest rates low, we would never have a bust. We'd always have constant prosperity. And so the bank, so you push the inquiry further and say, well, why did the banks do that? And maybe it was because they kept issuing more and more fiduciary media. Prices are going up, and maybe speculators are starting to think, you know what, I'm going to turn in this fiduciary media for the actual gold, because, you know, they're thinking the banks are being a bit too aggressive or whatever, or maybe the gold's flown to other countries that aren't expanding as much. But the point, then maybe legislative constraints kick in, right, because the government says the banks have to maintain a minimum reserve ratio of, you know, reserves backing up the fiduciary media, or I should say the money substitutes. And so maybe the banks, the reason they chicken out and stop issuing more fiduciary media, which then makes interest rates go up, is maybe because their reserves are getting down to the legislative minimum. And so then the people don't blame the bankers directly, so they're just obeying the law. It's so politicians, they put in place those silly regulations. Okay, so that's the mindset that Mises is reacting to here. And he's saying, there is a sense that, yeah, historically, the banks do abandon their inflationary policies well before they the collapse of the currency. And so it's true from a narrow point of view to say the banks caused the onset of the crisis, that the crisis didn't need to start when it did. The apparent prosperity could have continued even longer had the banks continued to just keep pumping in more and more fiduciary media. That's true, but Mises is saying it's wrong to conclude, therefore, we could have unending prosperity, a perpetual boom, if the banks would just always be good sports about it and never raise interest rates. Because he said, ultimately, if you just kept doing that, injecting more and more and more fiduciary media, where even the increments had to keep going up, then ultimately the currency collapses. And at that point, it doesn't matter how much of these banknotes you print, if nobody's holding them, that's that. And to see that, you know, this isn't just a matter of psychology. You might think, oh, well, what if we could just keep reassuring the public that everything was fine? No, because it's a technological thing, too, or a physical constraint. That the subsistence fund was not big enough to bridge the gap from us moving from, you know, an average period of production that was 5 years to one that was 8 years or whatever. That just physically there was not enough saved goods to be able to maintain everyone's standard of living during that transition phase. And so we're going to hit a wall physically. Doesn't matter how many banknotes you print up, if the capitalists have not accumulated enough cans of tuna fish and enough apartments and so on, while we redirect our efforts to making cans of tuna fish that won't shoot out of the pipeline until down the road, we're going to hit a period where there's no tuna fish to be had. And you can print up as many banknotes as you want and give them to people, and people can offer more and more units of money for a can of tuna fish, but if it doesn't physically exist, it's not going to feed anybody. All right, so that's the idea. So the point is, yes, the banks could perpetuate the boom, postpone the crisis, but it wouldn't, no matter what, at some point, an unsustainable boom is going to collapse. That's why we call it unsustainable. And moreover, the longer you perpetuate this artificial boom, the worse the crash is going to be. So it's actually good that the banks chicken out sooner than they physically have to. Because then, yes, it's bad, but it's better to realize the mistake sooner rather than later, because the crisis will be that much worse the longer the prior boom period was. Okay, well, we're out of time, and obviously I don't have time to answer your questions. I will do that hopefully before this week's office hours session on Saturday. Thanks, everyone, for signing up. I hope you enjoyed this. If you haven't been doing the reading, I would encourage you, now that you've heard the lectures, to try to read the relevant excerpts, because it is an important book, and don't be intimidated by it. Mises is a tough writer, don't get me wrong, and this book is harder than Human Action is, but it really, there's a lot of stuff in here that isn't in Human Action. And I think even just this chapter 19, just reading it a few times, will give you insights into how Mises thinks about the business cycle. Okay, I need to sign off because David Gordon's got a class, I think, and I will see some of you on Saturday. And I'll, of course, post the information about your quiz when it's available. Mm-hmm.